Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the last episode of Season 5. Series 5, we still haven't decided whether there are seasons or series, of Why Would You Tell Me That with me, Dave Moore, him, Neil Denimer. Thank you so much for joining us. We are proudly part of the Acast Creator Network, and you can get us on the social medias. We are at Why Would You Tell Me That on Instagram. He's at Neil Denimer Comedy, and I am at Dave Today FM. And we've reached the end, Neil.
Yes, we have reached the end. However, we're going to go out with a bang, Dave.
Okay.
I know you like your food. I know you like certain genres of food. I think your favorite food genre is Italian?
See.
In the second half of the show, I'm going to tell you, said this to you last week, that everything that you thought you knew about Italian food was wrong.
Now, that is such a big claim and a potentially disturbing claim, Neil. Because I don't want these things I know to be true to affect my enjoyment of Italian food if I am to learn that they are in fact falsehoods.
Well, we're going to talk to an Italian journalist, Mariana Giusti, from the Financial Times, who has written a hugely popular article with the same title, slightly different title, Why Everything I Thought I Knew as an Italian About Italian Food, essentially, is Wrong. And if she still likes it, as an Italian,
okay,
you'll be okay.
Okay.
Has that satisfied you?
Yeah, as long as I can still enjoy my pappardelle ragù and my gnocchi and all those things, I'll be more than, if I can keep eating tiramisu, I'll be very happy.
If you, I've just stopped saying it like that. So for part one, because it's the end of the series, I've got some random facts for you. Usually they're connected with the stuff in the second half. But these are kind of, some of them are a bit more topical, okay?
Okay.
Why is Dolly the sheep called Dolly? So Dolly was a sheep that was cloned.
Famous. The cloned sheep, yeah, the famous cloned sheep.
And the reason I ask you this is because her fleece was valued at about 30 grand on the Antiques Roadshow this week. Did you see that?
Oh, no.
Yeah, somebody who worked in the institute that cloned Dolly, she was the first sheep to be cloned from an adult cell, went on the Antiques Roadshow. They said, how much is this worth? And I think it was her second or third shearing, shall we say, and it was 30 grand. But why was she called Dolly?
Oh, this does sound like the kind of thing that I would have known or should now know, but I don't, Neil. I suppose that in itself is the true essence of this podcast. So tell me, why was Dolly called Dolly?
Well, I think people probably knew it at the time because she was in all the papers at the time. But you know what? We think of scientists as mature adults, I think.
100%, yeah.
At the forefront of progress.
Yeah.
Her DNA was from the mammary gland of a sheep. So she was called after Dolly Parton.
No, just because Dolly Parton has big boobs.
Yeah, they thought, oh, boobs. Who else has boobs? Dolly Parton.
That's ridiculous.
And they called her Dolly. If she'd come from a rectal cell, would she be called Farage? Nobody knows. But that is why she's called Dolly. She was cloned from a cell taken from mammary gland of a 6-year-old Finn Dorset sheep and an egg cell taken from a Scottish blackface sheep. Only acceptable blackface. She was born to her Scottish blackface surrogate mother on the 5th of July 1996, but Dolly had a white face. So that was one of the first signs that she was a clone.
She was a clone, right.
She was genetically related to her surrogate mother. She would have had a black face.
Gotcha.
Right, yeah, so that just is a topical one.
If the scientists, being the bawdy, you know, Sun newspaper readers that they seem to have been, they probably considered calling the sheep Samantha Fox, but couldn't because of the animal connotations and the confusion of the fox, of course, a predator of the sheep.
Whoa. I'd still stick with the boobs level of I mean, no. I'm surprised that they came up with the whole cloning thing while still trying to write that thing into the calculator 80085 or whatever it is.
58008. Come on.
I knew you'd know it, right? Okay, so that's just a topic I would have started off.
Amazing.
Whet your appetite, okay? There's only one country between Norway and North Korea.
Whoa, slow down, Poncho.
Yeah.
There's only one country between... Oh, Russia!
Yes. And you live there.
Oh my God, I did. So Norway extends so far north that it bypasses Finland and touches Russia.
Curves over Finland. It dunks on Finland, essentially.
Yeah. And then Russia... being the biggest landmass, country landmass in the world, stretches all the way into North. Oh my God, that's incredible.
That's kind of insane, isn't it? You were the youngest person in the world at one point.
Ah, this one I have heard. That is so cool. Yeah, because now it presumably is for a very brief moment.
Yeah, at some point you were born and the next person to be born happened just after you in the world. So you were the youngest person in the world. So they're the sort of things, except maybe the Dolly one, that you might just see in a passing internet thing, right?
Sure.
But this one, I've got two doozies. These are my favourites now in a long time.
Go on.
Jimmy Carter, the president of the US.
Yeah.
Yes, former president of the US. He's a fine age now, in fairness to him. He's almost 100. He was involved in the cleanup of the first serious nuclear accident in the world.
Jimmy Carter was?
Yeah.
The president of the United States was in... was he president at the time? No, that would be super cool.
He was. No, he was the president, Dave. Yeah. And he went, you know something? I think I can take some time off from this Iranian hostage crisis, go up to Canada and sort this shit out. So, listen, they said he didn't get a second go up being the president because he didn't delegate enough. And you have to agree that him getting involved in the cleanup of a reactor accident would suggest, I mean... He really micromanaged Dave.
I realise how stupid a question this was.
It was December 1952.
Okay.
Right? And it was in rural Ontario and it had the first serious reactor accident in the world. It partially melted down. It's in this place called Chalk River Nuclear Laboratories, about 200 kilometres north of Ottawa. And he was 28.
What job did he have that would have seen him go to the scene of a nuclear meltdown?
He was the body double for the Incredible Hulk.
You'd easily know it's the last episode.
Have we gotten D-Mob happy? He was Black Spider-Man. You know, when Spider-Man becomes
Venom. Venom,
That's who he was.
Right.
No, so he was in the US Navy. Okay. And he was a lieutenant or a lieutenant, obviously, of the US Navy. And he helped disassemble the reactor under pretty intense radiation. Like they were all in the, you know, the Intel ads, but without the happy music. They're all in the white protective equipment. And they did 90-second shifts to reduce radiation exposure.
I was going to say, like 1952, I mean, I don't know what the understanding of radiation exposure would have been. Obviously, would have been high enough. They were ready to work in 90-second shifts and all that. But like to think that he has now lived, to be 100, and certainly doesn't show any signs of overexposure to radiation. This is phenomenal.
Yeah, he actually said it in his autobiography. He said there were no apparent after effects from this exposure. Just a lot of doubtful jokes amongst ourselves about death versus sterility.
Right. Okay. But maybe his long life could be attributed to some kind of exposure to radiation that mutated cells in a way we don't understand.
And that is why you're not a doctor and shouldn't be let near a hospital in any way, shape or form. We established last week you eat grass. Put this on the list of stuff that Dave does to endanger himself and others. But it's quite interesting why, if you think about this, this is in Canada, right? And he was one of 150 US military personnel.
Yeah, why did the Canadian military not look after it?
Who worked? Well, there was a cleanup. 150 US military personnel, 860 facility staff, and 170 Canadian military personnel,
right,
and 20 construction contractors. Well, so it happened in December 12th, 1952. There's a series of failures. There's a brief surge. It melted some of the reactor's fuel rods, and it maxed out about three times the facility's power, okay? So nobody was seriously injured. Nobody was killed, and they monitored the contamination, and then it led to people, you know, thinking, okay, we've got to change the procedures that we have for this. But this was the NRX reactor. It was primarily used to probe the nuclear properties of matter and help advance reactor technology, right?
Okay.
With the idea of at some point we're going to generate electricity from this.
Yeah.
In the early days of cancer radiation therapy, it provided the world's only ready source of radioactive isotope cobalt-60, which they first used in Canada in 1951 to bombard tumours.
Wow.
But less public, and this is possibly why the US got involved, was the use of the reactor by the Navy in America to test the uranium oxide fuel.
Oh, okay.
And it was developing for the first nuke-powered subs.
Right, okay. So that's got to be kept secret.
That's got to be kept secret. So off he went, put himself in harm's way, and then many years later, what, 1976, 1977, becomes the President of the United States.
I wonder did he use that in any of his campaigns, you know, kind of like, look, you know, because, I mean, Americans, they tend to use that kind of bravery. You know, I've got this medal and I fought in this war and I did, you know, I wonder did he ever walk up to a campaign somewhere and go, I'm the guy who jumped into the nuclear facility. Okay, radioactive man.
Yeah, then have a second head on his shoulder. Just going, I vote for Jimmy Carter. I always got the impression he was of that generation that was a bit more modest.
Right,
Wasn't he a Georgian peanut farmer, I think? That was
these are things I did not know. That, in fact, it alone is amazing.
Yeah, he was a bit more kind of, dare I say, honourable. Or that's how he comes across, anyway, before it all descended into that sort of using your record. But maybe he did make use of it. I don't know, actually, on that fact.
And, of course, I've got to throw into this conversation that peanuts are, in fact, not true nuts. They are legumes.
Oh,
yeah.
Are they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Are you allergic to peanuts?
No, but I do hate them in chocolate.
Do you like them in other things?
Yeah, I like them plain. I will eat peanuts till the Daves come
home. Reference to last week's podcast.
Yeah. So I would eat a handful of peanuts and then eat a Mars bar. But if you gave me a Snickers, I would punch you in the face. Like, this is, I'm being honest. I hate nuts in chocolate.
What? That's odd. Do you not like Nutella?
No, hate it.
Ferrero Rocher?
No, gick. To the top of a Cornetto. Well, if I buy a Cornetto or get given a Cornetto, I have to give the top to my missus.
Right.
She's to eat the nuts bit, and then I can eat the rest.
Do you eat the bottom of it with the ice cream at the bottom?
Yes.
Okay. So would you have absolutely kicked off of the ambassador's residence if you came out with that muck?
I would have said, what else have you got there, Senor Delgado? I'm assuming it was a Colombian embassy, even though they're plainly French or Swiss at the very least.
So, the Colombian embassy. Yeah. Senor Delgado.
Straight away, that's where I was. I was at the
Spanish cyclist who was up against Stephen Roach in the 80s, wasn't it?
I don't know why.
Oh, you're spoiling us. Why did you have so many Ferrero Rocher left over, Mr. Delgado? Oh, you're using them as fuel on the of the Alpe d'Huez ascent, were you? Do you know, I once asked what the most embarrassing thing an audience member had ever done.
Yeah.
And he said, I was at the ambassador's residence once, right?
Yeah.
And I went, no. And he goes, I said, how did it go? And he goes, not well. It was some black tie event. And I said, what happened? And he goes, there was a free bar, right?
Yeah.
I said, what happened? He goes, well, as I fell over, right, he got so buckled that he was standing at a bar and he was down in drinks and he did. You're not a drinker now and I drink infrequently, but there is a thing where you drink and you don't know you're drunk. I think Billy Connie was saying like your legs are drunk first and you try to walk away.
So he
tried to walk away and his legs went, I don't think so. Right? So he leaned over and he grabbed something to steady himself and it was a tree in a huge big plant pot. Now it was about 25 feet high and he just fell backwards. Pulled the tree out of the pot, smashed the pot, made bits of everything. And I said, that is pretty bad. He goes, it gets worse. I said, how could it get worse? He goes, it was a charity event to raise awareness for the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. And he had basically fucked a tree in front of everybody.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know the scientific explanation as to why your legs get drunk first? It's one of the most incredible things I've ever learned, right? There was a documentary on the BBC years ago, on getting drunk.
Yeah.
And apparently, it's a long time since I saw it, but I remember it, so I'm assuming it's right, but check my facts and see. as you're getting drunk,
yeah,
the cerebellum is at the base of your brain, and that's what controls your movement.
Right.
So your cerebellum, as your body is filling up with alcohol and your bloodstream is filling with alcohol, your cerebellum gets drunk first in relation to the brain. So it's your movement that is first affected by alcohol.
Wow. Your cerebellum is just a lightweight. Just,
yeah, basically, that's yeah. what it is. Somebody check that. I don't know for sure if that's true, but I definitely remember a BBC documentary about it.
Your amygdala is at the back of your brain, just sitting there, hardcore, just down in
shots.
Down in shots. Yeah, fucking pussy. Get in one.
Cerebellum's drunk again.
Yeah, he's just sitting on the stairs with a bottle of gin going, you are pricks. I could have been somebody.
Well, slicing the synapses between neurons, just going, get rid of that, get rid of that. You don't get even remember this.
I won't remember any of this in the morning, you bunch of bastards. That's
drunk Neil is my favourite Neil.
Other people have said that. Okay, and I have a fact for you. This kind of blew my mind. How fatal would you say rabies is?
Rabies?
Yeah. Like, you never hear of anybody getting rabies, do you?
No, and if you do, I'm sure at this point there's some kind of an... antiviral or something. Yeah,
There are.
Not fatal, I would suggest.
And rabies, you know, isn't in Ireland.
No.
Because they're very careful to make sure it's not.
I mean, untreated, example, I would imagine you're not going to fare very well. But I would suggest that we're probably, given that, you know, treatment is important for the... I'm going to go 95%. 90% treated.
99%?
Non-fatal.
Symptomatic rabies is almost 100% fatal.
What?
100% fatal. Yeah. I don't know why I'm saying it like that. It doesn't make it any less weird.
How can it be?
Okay, well, if you get the symptoms, so say you get bitten by something, right?
Yeah.
Say you get bitten
yeah.
by a bat, and there's been examples of this. Get bitten by a bat, for example.
Oh, nothing bad can happen from anyone getting bitten by a bat or biting a bat. That we've categorically proven that's absolutely fine.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
If you get bitten by a bat and the bat has rabies and you don't get treated before you get symptoms, so symptoms can develop afterwards.
So is it too late?
Yeah. It is almost 100% fatal. This is according to the World Health Organization. Because I saw a stat saying 6 people have survived rabies, symptomatic rabies, if they haven't been vaccinated.
Sorry, like ever?
This is what it said. Now, I cannot back that up.
Sure.
But I went online and looked. I said, that can't be true, is it? But the WHO says the symptomatic rabies is almost 100% fatal. So what happens is, and this is from the University of Nebraska, a Minnesota man is the first, and this was this year, reported fatality due to rabies in the US despite receiving appropriate post-exposure prophylaxis. So basically, there's a handful of people who have survived rabies that we know of. If you get bitten, before you get the symptoms, go and you get treated. And you get, it's PEP, basically, that's what it's called. It's a treatment that consists of a series of vaccinations and human rabies immunoglobulin injection.
Right.
At that point, you're much more likely, you'll be fine then at that stage.
Okay, you know? Okay.
A patient gets a series of rabies vaccines on specific days within a 2-week period, assuming they're not previously vaccinated.
Yeah.
Like, the 60,000 people, by the way, receive PEP annually in the US.
In the US?
Yeah. So they receive PEP. So if they get bitten by something, maybe the thing gets
may or may not have rabies. Gotcha, yeah.
Maybe the thing doesn't get tested, but they go and they get PEP.
Yeah.
So 60,000 people receive PEP annually in the US. During 2000 to 2021, an average of 2.5 people died from rabies every year in the US. But none received prophylaxis to prevent rabies before developing the symptoms. So basically, it's massively, massively effective. That older man, he was actually in his 80s and he had an underlying condition, was the first to die despite receiving the PEPs. But if you don't, gonzo.
Right. It would suck to be the half person that died annually. Because, I mean, like, you've lived your life, you know, obviously tough existence being half a person. Do we know, are they half divided in the middle? or like, you know, left to right side, or is it from the waist down? Or
I think the half person is Blackburn jersey, Blackburn Rovers jersey. They were sliced entirely in the middle.
Lengthwise,
that's how they were done.
Right, jeepers.
Yeah, by a tube door in the underground in London. And because it was London, everybody just ignored it.
Ignored it and just went on with their days.
As long as the doors closed.
Fell to the platform, but the other person, the other half, was inside. Yeah. And obviously the sterile conditions of the tube.
Of the underground tube, yeah. And the good thing is, it was their dominant, they were right-handed. And that was the bit that was in the tube.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, movement is difficult. You know, hopping and balancing with one arm and hopping. But look. Whatever it takes. But then having then to contract rabies and even post PEP to pass away. I mean, this is tough.
It's very sad. You would have thought that your life's lot of bad luck would be injected into your karma by by being severed in two by a tube door. But no, God had more in store for you. You know, sometimes I ask the guests when the podcast goes out, they say to me, when is the podcast coming out? And I go, your podcast is out next week. And sometimes I say to them, just listen to your part.
Yeah, yeah, just flick through part one.
Flick through part one. I think this might be one of those times.
I go 25 minutes in and just go from there. But where the music plays after the ads.
Yeah. Yeah. If you heard the word rabies, fast forward a little bit. Fast forward a little bit. Maybe don't listen to that part. But all of those things are true, which I did not know.
Absolutely incredible.
Stick with us in the second half because we're going to talk to Mariana Giusti, who has written one of the articles that I've read this year that just jumped out at me and explains that everything we thought we knew, and even that she thought she knew as an Italian, about Italian food is wrong. But it's fine. We can still eat it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to part two of Why Would You Tell Me That? I am delighted to be joined by a journalist who wrote a brilliant article in the Financial Times titled Everything I, an Italian, Thought I Knew About Italian Food is Wrong. And it's going to destroy all of Dave Moore's dreams and hopes because Italian food is his favourite food. Am I right, Dave?
Oh, Mary, why are you going to ruin my day?
Well, yes, Mary Giusti is going to ruin your day. Thanks for joining us, Mary.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thanks, Dave. Thank you for having me.
Benvenuto.
Grazie.
Oh, look, he's already started. Now, will he be as friendly by the end of this? So I suppose, broadly speaking, Mary, like, there's certain rules, and I use rules in inverted commas around Italian food and drink, and like, you know, cappuccino, you can't have a cappuccino after 11 o'clock or midday, I think. And tagliatelle has to have a width of 7 millimeters. And these have kind of been passed down by the elders from some bygone age, is the suggestion. But that might not necessarily be true. And a man called Alberto Grandi has been making some bold claims about this. So can you give us a little background on Alberto?
Absolutely. So Alberto is a professor of economics, actually, at the University of Parma. And he decided to specialize in the history of food economy and agriculture. And that was his way into this type of research. A few years ago, he wrote a book which didn't sell very much at first. It was called Di Origine Inventata. That's a play on word on the Italian expression Di Origine Protetta, DOP, which is stands for a protected designation of origin. So to give you an example, that would be a product like champagne or Parmigiano Reggiano.
See it on Italian cheeses sometimes, you see DOP.
Exactly. It's on so many Italian products. French products too, it's very common. And it obviously has legal implications because if it's a designation that implies that it's obviously linked to the retail price, but it also means that if you, Dave, are making some cheese in your house, you can use that designation if it's outside the region that enjoys rights.
Okay, Tracy, destroy the cheese. Destroy it now.
You just see cattle being moved out in the background of Dave's shot. And he wrote this book and then did a kind of spin-off podcast, which has gotten well over 1 million downloads. But he's been essentially calling out the mistruths about the origins of Italian foods.
Yeah, he has. He has. His podcast didn't start off, I don't think it was that popular at the beginning, until it was noticed by a famous Italian political commentator called Alberto Costa, who also has a daily podcast, which is about politics. But I think he gave a shout out to Alberto's podcast one day, and that increased its popularity. And I like to think that after our viral article, Alberto's work became even more popular. But it's also hugely controversial. He has a lot of enemies. Something that I mentioned in the article is how the Italian ambassador to Turkey was furious at him for slamming Italy's over 1,000 protected designations at a big international commerce conference. And Alberto told me, I didn't insult them. I just said they're excessive. But in truth, I know that what he meant was they're a load of rubbish.
Right.
To give you an example.
Yeah, let's ruin Dave's life. Okay.
I'm just interested as to what rugs are you going to pull out from under my culinary feet?
Something that is very easy to understand, a variety of red prawn, gambero rosso, that is very popular in higher-end culinary circles in Italy, is il gambero rosso di Mazara del Vallo, which is from a specific area, which was later found to be genetically identical to every other single red prawn across the Mediterranean, but it has a higher price tag. And that's commercial fraud in a way too. Although I shouldn't have said that. I don't want to be sued for defamation. I'm going to say the fact, which is that it is genetically identical to all its other cousins across the Mediterranean Sea.
Well, Dave Moore is, unlike most humans, he's actually 70% tiramisu. It's not water.
Oh, no, don't do anything to tiramisu. Not tiramisu.
Oh, tiramisu. Yes. Ugh. Off you go.
What is it, Mary?
Mary, ruin his tiramisu days.
So the deal with tiramisu, it's actually not that bad. I can tell you, for starters, it's 100% Italian. Okay. That hasn't been challenged ever. And something that Alberto is very adamant about is how his work doesn't question the quality or deliciousness of the food.
Okay.
It just questions the origin stories and the historical accuracy of the legends that are exploited basically by marketing around them. So tiramisu, you will find a gazillion places and families claiming they started it. But Alberto says something very simple, which is that the cheese mascarpone that is used in the original recipe could only be found before the so-called cold chain, so a post-industrial, post-war event. It could only be found in the Milan area.
Okay.
And that on top of that, the actual original ingredients are all stuff that you can only really find in the supermarket. They're all industrial products.
So there's no kind of romantic, you know, centuries old recipe of combining coffee and
Nana in some little tiny biscuits. Mezzogiorno cottage. No. Mascarpone was rarely found outside Milan before the 1960s, and the coffee-infused biscuits that divide the layers are pavesini, a supermarket snack, Dave, launched in 1948.
Oh, my God.
But it could still have been a really cool nonna with great taste.
Just only a little while ago, not in 1712 or something.
100%.
I don't know why that matters, because ultimately, if the dessert was invented 2 weeks ago and it's delicious, who cares? But I guess there is a kind of perception as a consumer of Italian food, as we all are. But as consumers, we kind of feel like, you know, this is a...
If you've been sold a story.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe you're not being sold a story when you go and order a tiramisu in a restaurant in Ireland. I don't know. But certainly the impression of all Italian food to me is that it's ancient and that the pizza margherita was invented for the queen of Italy, you know, in the 1500s or whatever. Maybe that's true. I don't know. But I suppose it's a different question than the DOP. So it's not true.
No, go on, Mary. Go on, do another one.
No, but what I was going to say is when you said that your perception of Italian food is that it's millennia old, that is a testament to the marketing genius that is beyond the narrative around Italian food, which is not less laudable than had it been true.
Yeah.
Because it is outstanding, the legends they've been able to create. So according to Alberto's research, pizza in general belongs to the wider family of disc-shaped...
flatbreads, I suppose.
Flatbreads, exactly. Yeah. They were really pervasive across the Mediterranean for centuries. And it belongs to the same family as pita.
Yeah.
Piada, pizza. In fact, if you go to Naples today, which is the place where it was originally created in Italy as a street food eaten by the among the poorest strata of society, it will still be served to you portafoglio. So it's
folded.
Called, yeah, wallet style folded, which is the same way you would serve crepe.
Yeah.
Pita in some cases. And before migrants started to return to Italy from the United States, people that had originally emigrated from America, it used to be topped not with tomato sauce, but with raw tomato, which is what you would see in a pita normally.
Yeah.
So it was something much more casual and informal. And even the custom, the pizzeria, is something that's really started in New York when migrants from the Italian South that left Italy because they were really poor, they were literally starving, started making some money and knew this type of food and decided it to sort of elevate it and start serving it in restaurants. But pizzerias really weren't a thing in Italy yet, to the point that where American soldiers landed in Sicily as allies to liberate the country from the Nazis, some rode back to their families in on the East Coast in America saying, guys, there aren't any pizzerias here. Like, what have you been telling me?
Yeah. But the argument's been going on in Manhattan for generations, which is the original Ray's pizza? The original's on 7th. What are you talking about, man? It's on 2nd Avenue. It literally was the original.
Yeah. right. Yeah.
1911 was the first one, and it was New York.
Oh, come on. 1911.
It's like an American getting here and going, Irish Americans going, why does no one say top of the morning to you? Because we never did. That was your invention.
Honestly, I would in my head, and this is so ridiculous, have an image of a Roman in a toga with one of those like long handled metal and putting a pizza into an oven, fired oven, and taking it. I'm so wrong. 1911 in New York.
You're there in Pompeii going, you've overcooked that one, lads, anyway.
You've just described a scene out of Las Vegas as well, Dave.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Do you like carbonara, Dave?
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Guess what, Dave?
Oh, no.
Barry, you're up.
So carbonara is probably the most emblematic of the examples of what Alberto calls invented tradition. It's a dish that if you ask anyone, especially from Rome, they will get extremely defensive and protective about it. And that they will claim that it dates back to 18th, 19th century miners. Mm-hmm. If you can you imagine somebody who works in a mine in the 19th century who can decide he will only have the cheek of the pork? Yeah. It makes no sense.
And cream as well, yeah.
Yes, and eggs. So what turned out is, even within historians, this is something that is debated. And I read this book. If anybody's interested in the history of carbonara, I recommend reading an excellent book by Luca Cesari, who's a friend and collaborator of Alberto, called A Brief History of Pasta. Mm. I think he has about 30 pages on carbonara, in which he details the seven most historically credible origin stories. And one of them was the one that seemed to me to be the strongest, which was the story of a dinner cooked for the English and American armies in Emilia, in Italy, during World War II, where the chef was an Italian, but he could only use ingredients from the kitchen of the American soldiers. So they had powdered egg yolk, some bacon, and some pasta.
Oh my God.
A very good cream. And Harold Macmillan apparently was there
as well. And some cheese, obviously.
Yeah. And so this Italian charcoal worker's kind of origin story is generally regarded as nonsense now, apparently, Dave. Sorry about that.
I'm just wondering, what did the ancient Italians eat if they didn't eat any of the things I think they eat?
Well, Goethe, the German author, apparently he was a lover of Italy and he traveled it extensively. And apparently he says at least a couple of times in his books that he hasn't eaten anywhere as badly as he ate in Italy.
Wow.
Yeah.
You turned that one around, didn't you?
Seriously.
I mean, you did a good job on that. But there
it was France. The place of good cuisine really was France before the last century.
There does seem to be, in your article, a big difference between the people who've kind of swallowed these myths and the people who haven't. And the people who haven't are older people who remember stuff going, hold on, when I was growing up, there was none of that sort of stuff. So a lot of the older people that you interviewed, because you did talk to your own grandmother and you talked to various other older Romans, they kind of gave you a different insight, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually one of the reasons, I think you can like Alberto's work or not, but definitely the memory of my grandparents, one of them luckily still alive, is the grandma that I interviewed as part of the piece, is something that made me relate so strongly to his work and that made me feel like his ideas were really liberating in a sense, because especially as an Italian living abroad, I've always been associated with this stereotype, which I personally found exhausting. Like, I remember the classic snack of my grandfather, who wasn't a poor man when I was little and when I remember him, but he would just dip old bread in water or milk.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember my grandma giving me frozen food behind my mother's back, because my mom was a classic baby boomer concerned with, you know, prime, fine, organic. And my grandma had been through the war and she was like, this is amazing. I don't have to cook.
Yeah, put it in the microwave.
And what did your granny say? What did she say about pizzerias or mozzarella or any of that stuff?
Yeah, I hadn't, until I got the commission to write the piece, I hadn't realized quite the extent of how, in my opinion, right Alberto was. Because, for example, I remember her mentioning that she didn't grow up with pizza. And she had told me that the first time she had pizza, I think she was in her 20s. She was around 25. So it was definitely after the end of the war. My grandma was born in 1935. But then I went back to her when I was writing and I asked her a few more questions. And I also realized she didn't know what a mozzarella was until the first supermarket chain opened in our town in the 60s. Which, wow. Again, shocking. Shocking.
Really shocking.
Yeah.
There was a 97-year-old man who, Dave, only had pasta on Sundays.
Yes, as well. Yes.
Because, again, like Irish people, we are stereotyped with the potato. And you would think that Italians stereotyped with pasta, that it's just, you know, everywhere, all the time, forever.
No, but they were so poor. They had a lot of vegetables.
Mm.
They had a lot of soup. And they had a lot of...
Beans, vegetables. Beans. Beans. Yeah. Grains. I make
a soup for my friends every St. Stephen's Day. I'm not sure what it's called in Italy, but... 26th
of December.
A load of my friends come over and I live near the beach and we go for a winter walk on the beach back to my house. And some of them are vegetarians and some of them are not, whatever. So I just cook roasted tomato soup with days-old ciabatta, torn up and put in the soup. And it's supposed to be the kind of the poor man's soup. So to fill the soup up, you put the bread in, the bread expands or whatever. And again, when I'm cooking this, it's delicious. Everyone loves it. But to me, I am cooking something that is like millennia old and has this, you know, rustic, you know, poverty strewn beauty to it. But I could be cooking something that was invented in 1966.
Yeah. Absolutely. Especially because tomato is something that definitely came after the so-called discoveries.
Yeah, that's true.
Found tomatoes.
What about the Italian Mediterranean diet then that is so lauded around the world of, again, sliced tomato, mozzarella, extra virgin olive oil, a little bit of pepper. Again, like, this can't be ancient. It can only be recent.
Yeah, the theory of the Mediterranean diet being the healthiest around is something that was popularized by the research of this American scholar, medical scholar, I think, mm-hmm. called Ansel Keys, who had examined, I think, blood samples among different communities in the United States. And he found that the healthiest profiles were those of immigrants that came from southern Italy. Now, modern researchers attribute the healthy state of those blood samples to the fact that people from the Italian South had eaten way less. And that was why they were actually healthier and they had less fats in them. Because actually, the modern Southern Italian cuisine is like the fattest, greasiest, heaviest thing you will find, even for an Italian.
This sort of begs the question, though, like, why did these myths develop? Why are people now insisting that these are ancient recipes? What has it got to do with identity that makes these legends so easy to believe? Why do we want to believe them?
Oh, my God. You've asked so many questions with, like, one, because it's opening up so many boxes. So when it comes to, I think what we're really saying is, why did it go viral? This idea that it was the best food in the world and that it was really ancient and that it was legitimate, or that all these legends had legitimacy. This is something that Alberto's work explains with the work of an English academic who wrote The Invention of Tradition. So he was the guy who shown how all the rituals, for example, around the monarchy were things that had been purposely invented rather than being part of a long-standing royal ritual tradition. So he applied this sort of modus operandi and research lens to Italian food and realized that what happened in the population is that when a country loses a sense of tradition, of identity, when a country loses a sense of identity due to a deep historical trauma, which would have been obviously the world wars, what it does is it then goes on to create an invented tradition to make up for the loss of its identity.
Of course.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what happened is in the post-war period, Italy experienced an unprecedented economic boom and people went from having nothing to eat to having endless choice. And they rejected their real identity, which was, I think what Alberto said to me was their real identity had been trying not to starve.
And
yeah,
I can see why you would want to forget that. And you would want to tell your children, oh, because Princess Margherita had asked the chef that she wanted something special.
Definitely.
But I think you're also asked about why it's still so pervasive, these beliefs. And I think there's a dichotomy there with economic and political ramifications. There's a political aspect whereby believing in these legends then morphs into gastronationalism and gastropurism. In Italy at the moment, there's the first government who set up a ministry of food sovereignty that had never existed before. And from an economic point of view, the food and drink sector is responsible for a very large share of the national GDP. So it's obviously something that people want to protect.
Yeah.
And because it's 2023, it gets dragged into the culture war, because everything gets dragged into the culture war. Pigeons, stones, the color of the sky, Dave's jumper, everything. So you have the right wing parties in particular tending to believe these as this wonderful term, gastro-nationalism, Dave.
Wow.
And if you look up Salvini, who's a right wing politician, basically, if you look up him eating, there are millions of pictures of him eating everything. Basically, him eating is what, if you looked up Putin hunting, it's the same thing.
Oh, no.
Possibly
right.
For the same purpose. So, but they're really into this, like, this tradition that doesn't actually exist, really.
You're absolutely right. It's such a powerful propaganda tool, and it's something so very agreeable. Like, who wouldn't like an old lady making tortellini? Like, there isn't one person who's going to say, that's not a lovely, nice, uncontrovertibly beautiful thing to look at. The political dimension of this is very strong, but I think it's political, but it's also exclusionary when it's about... So the reason Alberto cares about a historical accuracy is because the history actually teaches us that we're all sort of cousins, right? So our attitude with America should be like, look at that. We were both making pizza. We're the same. Whereas the Italian interpretation of history is we are better. We did it first. We have the original. Yours shouldn't even be called pizza. And that is wrong. But there's also an example from recent events that I quote in the article, which is when during a traditional festivity in the city of Bologna, the Archbishop, I believe, suggested making a version of tortellini, which was pork-free for Muslim people, immigrants or like citizens that wanted to take part in the celebrations. And Salvini said, this is outrageous. This is an attack of our tradition. They want to destroy us, or like, I'm paraphrasing something along these lines.
Sure.
I keep saying all these things in brackets because I'm such a writer. I can like hear the FT lawyers saying, have you fact checked?
It's funny, you've said you're paraphrasing. I'm pretty sure legally that means we're all fine.
Anyway, Salvini said, this is an attack on our culture. This is an attack on our tradition. I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of they're trying to destroy us and our culture and our history. And Alberto responded with the very hard to argue with fact that historically, tortellini never had pork in the restaurant. So by offering pork free tortellini, they would be making a version that was closer to the most
iteration.
That used to be with, filled with poultry. So, like, you know, Dave, I'm taking taking a mick by saying I'm going to ruin your desserts.
Sure.
But this idea of purity, why we kind of think it's a little bit funny, actually has real world ramifications. Because once you say something is exclusionary, this is the purity. We are trying to protect purity.
Yeah.
That actually has real world ramifications. There's a great kind of image at the start of this article where you meet Alberto Grandi, the man we're talking about here, in Parma. And it's like, it's in this cafe and he's worried, like, they hate me here, he says. And and we've already heard about how the ambassador said stuff to him. But because you wrote an article and popularized his work even further, have you had any sort of blowback or anything?
Yes.
Really?
Hardcore. So I had never been trolled before, and the experience of being trolled, it's pretty brutal. I wasn't expecting. I've always kind of like thought, who cares? They're strangers. But when you're looking at your phone every 5 minutes and you have dozens of notifications of people insulting you personally and looking up details about you and picking things out of your pictures, your articles, your byline, whatever, it's weird. It's a weird experience.
It's unnerving. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard not to be affected. Mm. And it was ironic because on the one hand, it was brilliant in the way that they were proving my point. Because I didn't get trolled by British people. I got trolled by Italian gastronationalists. Because when the piece first went viral, it did so in the Anglophone bubble on Twitter. And that was all praise. And then Salvini picked it up. The Italian press picked it up. What happened is that the release of my article, by total coincidence, coincided with Italy submitting its application to for the national cuisine to receive intangible UNESCO heritage.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
So that looks like you're absolutely taking the piss out of that suggestion.
Wow.
Yes, absolutely. So I can see why they would think that it was a conspiracy, but do they seriously think the FT have something like, no.
What have the FT got to gain from this exact scenario?
Do you remember when you wrote your book, Dave, Irish Dancing is a Load of Rubbish, and it debuted during Riverdance's interval dance in the Eurovision? It's a similar thing. So, Dave, I'm sorry I've kind of ruined some of your favourite dishes, but they still taste great.
No, if that's this is the thing. I don't think you have, okay?
Okay.
I think I still adore Italian food more than anything. I think, however, I will just think of it slightly differently. Not taste-wise, but I'll just realize, you know, I feel better informed is how I feel.
Okay. And know that this happens in every single country. Like,
hey,
I,
the Irish pub. I mean, if we uncover the truth for every single Irish pub.
I want to know.
Tell you.
Yeah. Oh, we'll let you into a little secret. We don't hang bicycles or typewriters off all our pubs.
Yeah.
Doors.
You know what? Irish people don't even drink. We've never had a pint in our life.
Okay, that's not true. That's not believable.
Dave's drunk right now. Dave has to get drunk to do this podcast. He needs to numb himself to my witterings. Dave doesn't even know my full name. That's how little
sure
he cares
I do,
about
Niall.
This podcast. Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure busting some of the myths around Italian food.
Brilliant.
But also admiring the marketing genius that has gone with various recipes and various products down throughout the years. Thanks, Mary. Welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That, Dave?
Wow.
Well.
Wow. Mariana.
Where do you stand on that now?
I'm okay. There were points in that discussion where I was worried that this was going to have a material effect on my enjoyment of the most delicious food that has ever existed. Everything the Italians make, except things with mushrooms, which are gross. But no, I find myself now still convinced that I can eat it. I just know that it's a delicious lie.
Oh, a delicious lie is a great name of an Edinburgh Fringe show. Can I ask you about the mushroom thing? You just don't eat mushrooms?
No.
Okay, because I thought it was going to be a weird Dave thing going, I do eat mushrooms on their own, but if you put mushrooms in the pizza, I don't have mushrooms in the pizza and I'll be disgusted. But
no, okay. I'm diametrically opposed to eating things that also grow between your toes.
Oh, mother of God. I've never had something done. That you've said before where I actually had to take off my glasses.
Yeah, I've only
recently started wearing glasses and I've never taken them off with disgust before. But
he did, and now his eyes are squinting because he can't see anything, but he needed to remove the glasses.
Wow, that is spectacular.
What a way to finish.
That horrendous image from the new face of Caniston. He's advertised everything else. Why not this? Ladies and gentlemen, Dave Moore, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Neil Delamere. Yeah.
Series 5. Series 6 coming up in February.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like, obviously, people listen to podcasts at all different times of the year. They live forever. But, I mean, it's Christmas. So we should just say, look, if you're listening to this around any Christmas ever, happy Christmas. And we'll see you in the new year. We can't wait. Series 6, we already... We see, when we're doing a series, we're working on the next one.
Yeah.
So Neil and I, as excited as we are about, you know, Bertha Benz and Mark Vins and the invention of Bailey's and the lies about Italian food, we're also working on season 6. And we're so excited to bring that to you. And we're already, you know, prepping and planning. And the great thing is, neither of us knows what the other one's doing. So this is always the exciting thing about it.
And we'll say once again, these are not topical. Pretty much never topical. We might talk about a couple of things that are happening in our life at the time. Celebrity Mastermind, Life of the Apollo. But like Dave, like his namesake, Dave, this can be played whenever. So all these podcasts, if you've just discovered this, go back and listen to our back catalogue. It's like Life of the Apollo on the Dave channel. Basically, it will last forever and ever and ever until it makes no sense anymore. So go and check out previous episodes. Listen to Dave on the radio on Today FM. I'm on tour everywhere in London and Glasgow and Belfast and Dublin and everywhere. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have your company, Dave. Happy Christmas.
And yours too, Neil. And to all of our listeners, thank you guys so much for tuning in. We see the numbers every week. We're blown away. And please, over Christmas, please keep giving us 5-star reviews and then review absolutely anything in the text. Absolutely anything.
We're 100% going to get a phone call from somebody in Apple going, you've broken the service conditions of...
Probably. Yeah. Book him here. Happy Christmas to Neil. Happy Christmas to all y'all. And yeah, thanks so much for listening.
Bye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.